Audible.com presents Funny in Farsi, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America. Written and read by Firouzeh Dumas. That's me. Leffingwell Elementary School. When I was 7, my parents, my 14-year-old brother Farshid, and I moved from Abadan, Iran, to Whittier, California. Farid, the older of my two brothers, had been sent to Philadelphia the year before to attend high school. Like most Iranian youths, he had always dreamed of attending college abroad, and despite my mother's tears, had left us to live with my uncle and his American wife. I, too, had been sad at Farid's departure, but my sorrow soon faded, not coincidentally, with the receipt of a package from him. Suddenly, having my brother on a different continent seemed like a small price to pay for owning a Barbie complete with a carrying case and 4 outfits, including the rain gear and mini umbrella. Our move to Whittier was temporary. My father, Kazem, an engineer with the National Iranian Oil Company, had been assigned to consult for an American firm for about 2 years. Having spent several years in Texas and California as a graduate student, my father often spoke about America with the eloquence and wonder normally reserved for a first love. To him, America was a place where anyone, no matter how humble his background, could become an important person. It was a kind and orderly nation full of clean bathrooms, a land where traffic laws were obeyed and where whales jumped through hoops. It was the promised land. For me, it was where I could buy more outfits for Barbie. We arrived in Whittier shortly after the start of second grade. My father enrolled me in Leffingwell Elementary School. To facilitate my adjustment, the principal arranged for us to meet my new teacher, Mrs. Sandberg, a few days before I started school. Since my mother and I did not speak English, the meeting consisted of a dialogue between my father and Mrs. Sandberg. My father carefully explained that I had attended a prestigious kindergarten where all the children were taught English. Eager to impress Mrs. Sandberg, he asked me to demonstrate my knowledge of the English language. I stood up straight and proudly recited all that I knew. White, yellow, orange, red, purple, blue, green. The following Monday, my father drove my mother and me to school. He had decided that it would be a good idea for my mother to attend school with me for a few weeks. I could not understand why 2 people not speaking English would be better than 1, but I was 7, and my opinion didn't matter much. Until my first day at Leffingwell Elementary School, I had never thought of my mother as an embarrassment, but the sight of all the kids in the school staring at us before the bell rang was enough to make me pretend I didn't know her. The bell finally rang, and Mrs. Sandberg came and escorted us to class. Fortunately, she had figured out that we were precisely the kind of people who would need help finding the right classroom. My mother and I sat in the back while all the children took their assigned seats. Everyone continued to stare at us. Mrs. Sandberg wrote my name on the board, F-I-R-O-O-Z-E-H. Under my name, she wrote I-R-A-N. She then pulled down a map of the world and said something to my mom. My mom looked at me and asked me what she had said. I told her that the teacher probably wanted her to find Iran on the map. The problem was that my mother, like most women of her generation, had been only briefly educated. In her era, a girl's sole purpose in life was to find a husband. Having an education ranked far below more desirable attributes, such as the ability to serve tea or prepare baklava. Before her marriage, my mother, Nazire, had dreamed of becoming a midwife. Her father, a fairly progressive man, had even refused the 2 earlier suitors who had come for her so that his daughter could pursue her dream. My mother planned to obtain her diploma, then go to Tabriz to learn midwifery from a teacher whom my grandfather knew. Sadly, the teacher died unexpectedly, and my mother's dreams had to be buried as well. Bachelor number 3 was my father. Like the other suitors, he had never spoken to my mother, but one of his cousins knew someone who knew my mother's sister, so that was enough. More important, my mother fit my father's physical requirements for a wife. Like most Iranians, my father preferred a fair-skinned woman with straight, light-colored hair. Having spent a year in America as a Fulbright scholar, he had returned with a photo of a woman he found attractive and asked his older sister Sedire to find someone who resembled her. Sedire had asked around, and that is how, at age 17, my mother officially gave up her dreams, married my father, and had a child by the end of the year. As the students continued staring at us, Mrs. Sandberg gestured to my mother to come up to the board. My mother reluctantly obeyed. I cringed. Mrs. Sandberg, using a combination of hand gestures, started pointing to the map and saying, "Iran, Iran, Iran." Clearly, Mrs. Sandberg had planned on incorporating us into the day's lesson. I only wish she had told us that earlier so we could have stayed home. After a few awkward attempts by my mother to find Iran on the map, Mrs. Sandberg finally understood that it wasn't my mother's lack of English that was causing a problem, but rather her lack of world geography. Smiling graciously, she pointed my mother back to her seat. Mrs. Sandberg then showed everyone, including my mother and me, where Iran was on the map. My mother nodded her head, acting as if she had known the location all along, but had preferred to keep it a secret. Now all the students stared at us, not just because I had come to school with my mother, not because we couldn't speak their language, but because we were stupid. I was especially mad at my mother because she had negated the positive impression I had made previously by reciting the color wheel. I decided that starting the next day, she would have to stay home. The bell finally rang and it was time for us to leave. Leffingwell Elementary was just a few blocks from our house, and my father, grossly underestimating our ability to get lost, had assumed that my mother and I would be able to find our way home. She and I wandered aimlessly, perhaps hoping for a shooting star or talking animal to help guide us back. None of the streets or houses looked familiar. As we stood pondering our predicament, an enthusiastic young girl came leaping out of her house and said something. Unable to understand her, we did what we had done all day. We smiled. The girl's mother joined us, then gestured for us to follow her inside. I assumed that the girl, who appeared to be the same age as I, was a student at Leffingwell Elementary. Having us inside her house was probably akin to having the circus make a personal visit. Her mother handed us a telephone, and my mother, who had thankfully memorized my father's work number, called him and explained our situation. My father then spoke to the American woman and gave her our address. This kind stranger agreed to take us back to our house. Perhaps fearing that we might show up at their doorstep again, the woman and her daughter walked us all the way to our front porch and even helped my mother unlock the unfamiliar door. After making one last futile attempt at communication, they waved goodbye. Unable to thank them in words, we smiled even more broadly. After spending an entire day in America, surrounded by Americans, I realized that my father's description of America had been correct. The bathrooms were clean, and the people were very, very kind. Hot dogs and wild geese. Moving to America was both exciting and frightening, but we found great comfort in knowing that my father spoke English. Having spent years regaling us with stories about his graduate years in America, he had left us with the distinct impression that America was his second home. My mother and I planned to stick close to him, letting him guide us through the exotic American landscape that he knew so well. We counted on him not only to translate the language, but also to translate the culture, to be a link to this most foreign of lands. He was to be our own private Rosetta Stone. Once we reached America, we wondered whether perhaps my father had confused his life in America with someone else's. Judging from the bewildered looks of store cashiers, gas station attendants, and waiters, my father spoke a version of English not yet shared with the rest of America. His attempts to find a water closet in a department store would usually lead us to the drinking fountain or the home furnishing section. Asking my father to ask the waitress the definition of sloppy joe or tater tots was no problem. His translations, however, were highly suspect. Waitresses would spend several minutes responding to my father's questions, and these responses, in turn, would be translated as, "She doesn't know." Thanks to my father's translations, we stayed away from hot dogs, catfish, and hush puppies, and no amount of caviar in the sea would have convinced us to try mud pie. We wondered how my father had managed to spend several years attending school in America, yet remained so utterly befuddled by Americans. We soon discovered that his college years had been spent mainly in the library, where he had managed to avoid contact with all Americans except his engineering professors. As long as the conversation was limited to vectors, surface tension, and fluid mechanics, my father was Fred Astaire with words. But one step outside the scintillating world of petroleum engineering, and he had two left tongues. My father's only other regular contact in college had been his roommate, a Pakistani who spent his days preparing curry. Since neither spoke English, but both liked curries, they got along splendidly. The person who had assigned them together had probably hoped they would either learn English or invent a common language for the occasion. Neither happened. My father's inability to understand spoken English was matched only by his efforts to deny the problem. His constant attempts at communicating with Americans seemed at first noble and adventurous, then annoying. Somewhere between his thick Persian accent and his use of vocabulary found in pre-World War II British textbooks, my father spoke a private language. That nobody understood him hurt his pride, so what he lacked in speaking ability, he made up for by reading. He was the only person who actually read each and every document before he signed it. Buying a washing machine from Sears might take the average American 30 minutes, but by the time my father had finished reading the warranties, terms of contracts, and credit information, the store was closing and the janitor was asking us to please step aside so he could finish mopping the floor. My mother's approach to learning English consisted of daily lessons with Monty Hall and Bob Barker. Her devotion to Let's Make a Deal and The Price is Right was evident in her newfound ability to recite useless information. After a few months of television viewing, she could correctly tell us whether a coffee maker costs more or less than $19.99. How many boxes of Hamburger Helper, Swanson's TV dinners, or Turtle Wax could one buy without spending a penny more than $20? She knew that, too. Strolling down the grocery aisle, she rejoiced in her celebrity sightings: Lipton tea, Campbell's tomato soup, Betty Crocker rich and creamy frosting. Every day, she would tell us the day's wins and losses on the game shows. He almost won the boat, but the wife picked curtain number two, and they ended up with a 6-foot chicken statue. The bad prizes on Let's Make a Deal sounded far more intriguing than the good ones. Who would want the matching Lazy Boy recliners when they could have the adult-size crib and high chair set? My mother soon decided that the easiest way for her to communicate with Americans was to use me as an interpreter. My brother Fashid, with his schedule full of soccer, wrestling, and karate, was too busy to be recruited for this dubious honor. At an age when most parents are guiding their kids toward independence, my mother was hanging on to me for dear life. I had to accompany her to the grocery store, the hairdresser, the doctor, and every place else that a kid wouldn't want to go. My reward for doing this was the constant praise of every American we encountered. Hearing a 7-year-old translate Persian into English and vice versa made quite an impression on everyone. People lavished compliments on me. "You must be very, very smart. A genius, maybe." I always responded by assuring them that if they ever moved to another country, they too would learn the language. What I wanted to say was that I wished I could be at home watching the Brady Bunch instead of translating the qualities of various facial moisturizers. My mother had her own response to the compliments. Americans are easily impressed. I always encouraged my mother to learn English, but her talents lay elsewhere. Since she had never learned English in school, she had no idea of its grammar. She would speak entire paragraphs without using any verbs. She referred to everyone and everything as "it," leaving the listener wondering whether she was talking about her husband or the kitchen table. Even if she did speak a sentence more or less correctly, her accent made it incomprehensible. W and TH gave her the most difficulty. As if God were playing a linguistic joke on us, we lived in Vitier, Whittier. We shopped at Witwoud Plaza, Witwoud Plaza. I attended Leffingwell School, Leffingwell School. And our neighbor was none other than Walter Williams. Despite little progress on my mother's part, I continually encouraged her. Rather than teach her English vocabulary and grammar, I eventually decided to teach her entire sentences to repeat. I assumed that once she got used to speaking correctly, I could be removed like training wheels and she would continue coasting. I was wrong. Noticing some insects in our house one day, my mother asked me to call the exterminator. I looked up the number, then told my mother to call and say, We have silverfish in our house. My mother grumbled, dialed the number and said, Please come right away, goldfish all over the house. The exterminator told her he'd be over as soon as he found his fishing pole. A few weeks later, our washing machine broke. A repairman was summoned, and the leaky pipe was quickly replaced. My mother wanted to know how to remove the black stain left by the leak. Y'all are gonna have to use some elbow grease, he said. I thanked him and paid him and walked with my mother to the hardware store. After searching fruitlessly for elbow grease, I asked the sales clerk for help. It removes stains, I added. The manager was called. Once the manager finished laughing, he gave us the disappointing explanation. My mother and I walked home empty-handed. That, I later learned, is what Americans call a wild goose chase. Now that my parents have lived in America for 30 years, their English has improved somewhat, but not as much as one would hope. It's not entirely their fault. English is a confusing language. When my father paid his friend's daughter the compliment of calling her homely, he meant she would be a great housewife. When he complained about horny drivers, he was referring to their tendency to honk. And my parents still don't understand why teenagers want to be cool so they can be hot. I no longer encourage my parents to learn English. I've given up. Instead, I'm grateful for the wave of immigration that has brought Iranian television, newspapers, and supermarkets to America. Now, when my mother wants to ask the grocer whether he has any more eggplants in the back that are a little darker and more firm because the ones he has out aren't right for Khorishto Bademjoun, she can do so in Persian, all by herself. And for that, I say hallelujah, a word that needs no translation. In the gutter. My father grew up poor in Ahvaz, Iran. His parents died at an early age, brought down by maladies readily cured today. He and his siblings survived through teamwork. And now, even though they are well into their 70s and have many kids and grandkids, they remain the central players in one another's lives. They have supported one another through deaths and illnesses and rejoiced in one another's good fortune. If someone were to ask my father about his proudest moment, he would probably mention the day his nephew, Mohammad, finally bought a house in America, or the day his great-nephew, Mohan, graduated from law school. Telling my father that his beloved older sister, Sedire, is angry with him is like putting a grown man in time out. He just can't stand it. The unbreakable bond between my father and his siblings serves as a testimonial that even though their parents lived very short lives, they did something right. My father's hardscrabble life also left him with a burning desire to get rich. History is full of stories of men overcoming poverty to amass great fortunes in steel or pig farming. Others reach great heights through education, becoming successful doctors and lawyers. My father was an educated man, but as a salaried engineer, he had not a chance of becoming rich, and he knew it. Unwilling to abandon his champagne wishes and caviar dreams, my father dreamed of ways to get rich that required neither hard work nor further education. His dream was that the doorbell would ring and he would answer it. Standing there would be a man in a three-piece navy blue suit who would ask him, Are you Kazem? Yes, my father would answer. Then the man would inform my father that through a series of unbelievable circumstances, he had come into boatloads of money. It was with this mindset that my father decided to enter Bowling for Dollars. In his attempts to embrace American culture, my father had joined the local bowling league. Every Wednesday evening, he would head off to the bowling alley, returning with spellbinding stories about strikes and gutters. Somewhere along the way, he started to believe that he was a gifted bowler. I suspect it had something to do with the American habit of generously heaping praise and encouragement on anyone who tries anything. At some point, someone must have yelled, Good job, Kaz! Which my father interpreted as, You should go on television and win a fortune! Bowling for Dollars was a game show that merged the fascinating world of bowling with the thrill of Las Vegas. All a contestant had to do to win the jackpot was roll two strikes in a row. The jackpot grew each time a contestant failed to win, taking the excitement up a notch. My parents and I watched the show religiously with my father's running commentary, which did not resemble that of traditional sports announcers, in the background.